From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
To that end, our plan respectfully requests $12 billion in short-term loans and a $6 billion line of credit.
The chief executives of Detroit's Big Three automakers returned to Capitol Hill to plead for $34 billion in federal aid to bail out the industry. We'll speak with the former president of the United Auto Workers Local 235, Wendy Thompson, and with longtime consumer advocate Ralph Nader. We'll also talk with him about Obama's cabinet picks. Code Pink's Medea Benjamin will join in. She's just returned from a trip to Iran. And we'll look at the blogging revolution. How free is the internet? From China to Egypt, from Yahoo to Google. We'll speak with author Anthony Lowenstein. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The chief executives of Detroit's struggling Big Three automakers returned to Capitol Hill Thursday to plead for a $34 billion taxpayer bailout. Speaking before the Senate Banking Committee, General Motors CEO Richard Wagner asked for the biggest haul, totaling $18 billion.
To that end, our plan respectfully requests $12 billion in short-term loans and a $6 billion line of credit. We are seeking an immediate loan of $4 billion and potentially a second draw of up to $4 billion in January, reflecting the current very weak state of automotive production and demand.
GM says it faces bankruptcy without $4 billion in federal loans by the end of the month, with billions more needed in 2009. Lawmakers said they were not convinced the automakers could return to profitability, even with a massive infusion of government cash. Chrysler was next, asking for $7 billion by the end of the year. Ford says it doesn't need an immediate loan, but requested access to a $9 billion line of credit. The hearing was briefly interrupted when a group of protesters began yelling, quote, "The bailout is a sellout," before being removed from the room. The car company executives are set to appear again today before the House Financial Services Committee. More on the auto industry bailout hearings after headlines. Iraq's three-member Presidency Council has approved the Status of Forces Agreement with the U.S., the last step needed for its adoption by the Iraqi government. The deal calls for U.S. withdrawal by the end of 2011. The Iraqi parliament approved it last week after agreeing to hold a national referendum in July. Violence is raging in several areas across Iraq. Seven Iraqis were killed and more than 100 were wounded in a double truck bombing in Fallujah. In Jalalah, four people were killed and 13 wounded when attackers opened fire on a civilian car. And in Mosul, two American soldiers were killed and nine Iraqi civilians were wounded in a car bomb attack near a checkpoint. In Israel and the occupied territories, Jewish settlers have unleashed a new wave of attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank city of Hebron. On Thursday, settlers shot at Palestinians, set fire to homes and olive groves, and defaced mosques and graves after Israeli troops evicted a group of settlers from a disputed Palestinian-owned home near a biblical site. Hebron resident Husni Abu Isafan was among the Palestinian victims of settler gunfire.
The settlers attacked us at the house and fired live bullets on us. With a handgun, they shot my father. Then later, they set the house on fire. There was only a few meters between us, maybe 1 or 1.5 meters. And he probably had his hand on the gun, too, when he shot my father.
Meanwhile, Israel says it'll allow foreign journalists and aid workers to enter the Gaza Strip for the first time in 4 weeks. Israel's barred reporters from Gaza since November 4th. Meanwhile, banks across the Gaza Strip have closed their doors because of a shortage of banknotes caused by the Israeli blockade. The Jerusalem Post reporting the Israeli military has drawn up new plans for an attack on Iran that does not include cooperation with the United States. An Israeli official said Israel would prefer to cooperate with the U.S. if it bombs Iran, but would still draw up plans in case it decides to act alone. It's the latest in a series of news reports said to originate from anonymous Israeli government officials on plans to strike Iran. In Canada, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has succeeded in shutting down Parliament to avoid a vote that would have thrown him out of office. Three opposition parties formed a coalition to oust Harper after he tried to introduce a series of controversial measures, including an attempt to end public financing of election campaigns. Harper said he'd try to push through a new budget when Parliament reconvenes.
On my advice, the Governor General has agreed to prorogue Parliament. Last Friday, I asked Canadians to give us their opinions on the parliamentary situation. That feedback has been overwhelming and very clear. They want Canada's government to continue to work on the agenda that Canadians voted for, our plan to strengthen the economy. When Parliament resumes on January 26th, the first order of business will be the presentation of a federal budget.
Harper's Conservative Party won a narrow re-election in October with just 37% of the popular vote. It's the first time in Canadian history a Canadian prime minister has sought to shut down Parliament to avoid a no-confidence vote. Back in the United States, President-elect Barack Obama is coming under criticism for apparently backtracking on a campaign promise for a windfall tax on oil company profits. The American Small Business League says the Obama campaign has deleted the windfall tax proposal from its transition website. An Obama aide said the windfall tax proposal was only proposed when oil was above $80 a barrel. Meanwhile, Obama's coming under criticism from an influential Democratic Congress member for deferring to President Bush on handling the economic crisis during the transition. On Thursday, Congressmember Barney Frank, the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, said, quote, "At a time of great crisis with mortgage foreclosures and autos, Obama says we only have one president at a time. I'm afraid that overstates the number of presidents we have. He's got to remedy that situation." Those, again, the words of Massachusetts Congressmember Barney Frank. A new study has found states with laxer gun laws have had the highest rates of handgun-related violence. Killings, police officer shootings, and cross-state violence were all highest in states that made it easiest to purchase weapons. The study was underwritten by a group of more than 300 U.S. mayors. In environmental news, Bank of America has announced it'll stop investing in mining companies specializing in the controversial practice of mountaintop removal. In recent years, Bank of America facilitated hundreds of millions of dollars in loans to companies like Massey Energy and Arch Coal that are involved in mountaintop removal coal mining. In a statement, the bank said it would change its policy in response to public pressure led by environmental groups. In media news, a new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists says more internet journalists are jailed today than journalists in any other medium. 45% of all jailed media workers, around 56 people, work in online media. Print journalists were next, with 53 currently jailed. We'll have more on the blogging revolution at the end of the broadcast today. And the private military firm Blackwater Worldwide could finally be seeing charges for the killings of 17 Iraqis in Baghdad in September of last year. The Associated Press reports Justice Department officials are considering charging Blackwater under a federal drug law that calls for a 30-year prison sentence for using machine guns in violent crimes. Blackwater is yet to face charges for the massacre, with government officials citing uncertain legal framework for prosecuting American contractors in Iraq. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. The chief executives of Detroit's Big Three automakers returned to Capitol Hill yesterday to plead for $34 billion in federal aid to bail out their industry. The company CEOs all drove to Washington in hybrid vehicles after being criticized for flying in for hearings last month in separate private jets. That time around, they were sent home empty-handed, with congressional Democratic leaders demanding detailed business and spending plans from GM, Ford, and Chrysler. The company submitted those turnaround plans before the Senate Banking Committee on Tuesday, promising major changes such as producing smaller, more fuel-efficient cars, reducing vehicle models, and slashing executive pay and bonuses. This is Richard Wagner, CEO of General Motors, speaking to reporters after the hearing.
The auto industry is an important one for the economy, and obviously it's under tremendous pressure, in part because of the global financial crisis. So we put forth a plan which we think adjusts our business to a smaller market.
Financially, GM is the most desperate of the big three. The company said it faced bankruptcy without $4 billion in federal loans by the end of the month, with billions more needed in 2009. But lawmakers said they were not convinced that the automakers could return to profitability, even with a massive infusion of government cash. After a six-hour hearing, Senator Chris Dodd, the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, said he would try to assemble a plan to revive the automakers, asserting that inaction is not an option.
A partial or complete failure of the domestic automobile industry would have ramifications far beyond manufacturing and pensions. It would affect virtually every sector of our economy. That includes the financial sector, which is a particular focus of this committee. A collapse within the auto sector would unquestionably worsen the credit crisis.
Dodd supports a taxpayer rescue, but called on the Bush administration or the Federal Reserve to save the automakers because Congress might not do so. Dodd said Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson must explain why the car companies, which support 1 in 10 U.S. jobs, are less deserving of assistance than Wall Street banks and insurance companies, which received a $700 billion financial rescue program in September.
The chief executives of the big three scheduled to appear again today before the House Financial Services Committee with opposition to an auto industry bailout strong among Republicans and even among many Democrats. Congressional leaders have given themselves 1 week to make something happen. Wendy Thompson is a retired worker at American Axle in Detroit and the former president of UAW Local 235. She joins us from Detroit, where she's helping organize a caravan of auto workers to Washington, D.C., scheduled to arrive Monday morning. Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, former presidential candidate, he catapulted to fame decades ago with his book Unsafe at Any Speed, which took on the auto industry. He joins us on the telephone from Washington, D.C. Let's start with Wendy Thompson. What do you think needs to happen right now?
Well, we're going to Washington in a caravan because we think it's very important that a rank-and-file worker point of view come into this debate. We don't think it's a question of saving corporations. It's a question of saving an industry, a question of saving working-class communities and the heartland of America. And we think a comprehensive reform industry has to happen. Our suggestion is to expand the industry to become transportation-based and alternative energy-based. We say that there's, instead of closing these factories, why don't we start to build products like light rail for mass transit or wind turbines for alternative energy? There is work that needs to be done to create a new society here in America, and a lot is at stake.
Wendy Thompson, your union has been basically backing the company CEOs in this effort to get a bailout, but at the same time, there are many Republicans, especially in the Congress, who see the contracts that the unions have had over the years as part of the problem that the automakers have. They claim that the labor costs of the auto companies are out of whack with other automobile companies, especially the Japanese companies. Your response to those criticisms?
The solution to the problem is not to take away more from workers that have already had so much taken from them. And it's a downward spiral. If they attack the decent paying jobs, then no one is going to have a decent paying job in the end. And this is not going to help us certainly get out of the economic crisis we're in. We are going to Washington not just for ourselves as auto workers, but for all American working people, because we think that unions and union wages is what's going to bring this country forward, not set it back. But we do feel that you do need government intervention here, that the corporations have not been pursuing the right path. And after all, the government is supposed to represent the people, and they should have oversight. And in fact, like they say, taxation without representation, well, if the American working people are investing in these corporations, they should have representation, too.
Compare, Wendy Thompson, the $700 billion bailout for the financial industry to what the automakers are asking for, and lay out the message you're taking to Washington. I mean, you're going big with these demands. If you're saying if they should get the bailout, what they should have to do, from saving auto workers' jobs to single-payer health care.
That's right. We are asking for big changes because that's what's necessary. We think that as auto workers that we have to stand firmly with saving the environment and saving the planet, and that if the auto corporations aren't doing it, the people have to take control here and say this is what has to happen. And that's the point of view we want to get across. We represent all working people.
Ralph Nader, you have been a long time a critic in the past of the auto industry. Your perspective now on them coming to Congress and asking for this bailout?
Well, one, first of all, it needs to be made clear that the workers and the UAW have given up far more than what the government subsidy will come down to in dollars if what the auto companies are asking for is accepted by Congress. They gave up huge billions of dollars in 2007, and they're giving up more in 2008. And what this whole debate is lacking is any concept of numbers. For example, if this is a $34 billion so-called bailout, what is it really? Well, it's subsidized loans, or maybe they'll turn it into loan guarantees. And depending on what the government gets in return, that is a fraction of what, as Amy said, of what Citibank and the financial industries have gotten in New York. The reason why there's so much focus on this on the auto companies is not just its role in the American economy, but it's public, and there are congressional hearings where the wave of gigantic bailout after bailout of Wall Street occurred largely on weekends in secret meetings between the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department, and the Goliaths on Wall Street. And these were sweetheart deals. Citibank got a huge sweetheart deal with very, very little reciprocity. Now, if the Congress is going to move to save the domestic auto industry, they're going to do it as taxpayers, as shareholders, as creditors, and they will drive a hard bargain. And as a result, the taxpayer can get preferred shares. They can get warrants so that if the companies recover, the taxpayer gets not just the money back, but a huge surplus. I mean, Ford Motor Company stock now is around $2.60. If Ford modestly recovers, it could go to $20. And, of course, those Treasury warrants and preferred shares would come out very, very handsomely, as they did in the Chrysler bailout when Iacocca turned it around in 1980 and 1981. So what I think should be done is for the government to say, okay, you want our help. We are going to own a part of you. We are going to be creditors and restructure you, remove the board of directors and the executives that are deemed not to be performing over the years, put people who know how to produce fuel-efficient, emission-controlled, safe motor vehicles in place, and reform the whole area of shareholder rights, because the government will be a shareholder. And since the government is effectively an insurer, they can move to apply the principle of insurance and loss prevention and produce motor vehicles and alternative transit, mass transit, that will damage less people on the highway and the environment. So I call it government capitalism, where the government plays the role of a shareholder, the role of a creditor, the role of an insurer, and restructures the entire industry. I must say, on the UAW, though, the biggest mistake the UAW ever made in this area was to support for 30 years against consumer and environmental groups on Capitol Hill a freeze on fuel efficiency. And because the government could not upgrade its fuel efficiency for over 30 years from the 1975 standards, the Japanese and other foreign competitors were able to eat eat into the market share of the domestic industry. And I'm glad to hear Wendy say that it seems like some workers at least understand that that's got to change.
Wendy Thompson.
Yes, I do feel that a union is the people, and that we as rank and file people must get more involved in saying what we feel needs to happen. The corporations have not listened to our point of view, but also we have not been as active as we need to be on these issues. And we mean to change that now, and that's why we're asking to people to join us in Washington on Monday. We're spending one day there. You can go to autoworkercaravan.org and see what the plans are. Join with us, because unions are democratic organizations. At least they can be if the memberships participate. And if we did have it, it'd be easier for people to get in unions, and hopefully there will be a law change that will allow what's called card check, where you have a union when the majority of the people sign cards. I think if American people were in unions, it would raise wages and it would help us develop industry and get out of the crisis we're in now. But also working people have to have say in the government, absolutely.
We're going to come back to this conversation in a minute. Wendy Thompson is a retired worker at American Axle in Detroit, former president of UAW Local 235. She's speaking to us from Detroit, helping to organize a caravan of auto workers who will be in Washington, D.C. on Monday to have their voices heard. Also, Ralph Nader is with us, catapulted to fame decades ago with his book Unsafe at Any Speed that took on the auto industry. This is Democracy Now! Medea Benjamin will be joining us, and then we'll be talking about the blogging revolution. The greatest number of journalists jailed today are online journalists. Stay with us.
Oh, 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 I can't take it anymore. You know I've been dropped the bomb on my city. Of the earth, you don't have to cry about all the destruction. The Motor City got their first. You don't need to tell me who is president. The hustle's tapping on my phone, trying to tell me this and that.
Nathaniel Mayer, please don't drop the bomb. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about the taxpayer bailout of the auto industry. Our guest, Wendy Thompson, retired worker at American Axle, former head of UAW Local 235, speaking to us from Detroit, and Ralph Nader. Ralph, before we go on with the conversation, I just wanted to remind people of your background. I don't think a lot of people know about how you catapulted to fame with Unsafe at Any Speed, that took on the Corvair, but more than that, it took on the entire auto industry. GM, ultimately, you sued for spying on you. Can you tell the story?
Well, I was a young lawyer, and I went to Washington to federally regulate the auto companies for safety standards, fuel efficiency, emission control in the mid-1960s. And we had good chair people of House and Senate committees, and Lyndon Johnson's willing to sign these bills. And the press was willing to cover the story as an ongoing story instead of a sporadic feature. And it was really the American dream of justice. And the result was the saving of millions of lives and injuries. And it led to the fuel efficiency laws and reduction in emissions from motor vehicles. And then we hit a stone wall the moment the United Auto Workers allied itself with the auto companies and stopped any increase in fuel efficiency standards. That opened the door for the SUV gas guzzlers, et cetera, and that differential that consumers saw between what foreign car companies were selling and what Detroit was selling. I view this proposed bailout as a mechanism to further those statutory regulatory goals, fuel efficiency, pollution control, and safety. What couldn't be obtained by regulation because of the opposition of the auto company lobbyists and their allies now can be obtained because Washington holds all the cards. The moment Washington signals that they're going to save the domestic auto industry, and the auto industry has no cards. Washington has all the cards, and if they represent the motorists and the environment and the workers, they can turn this crisis into a great opportunity. On the other hand, the right-wing forces in Congress and elsewhere want to use this crisis to break the union, to destroy the higher standard of living that auto workers have been receiving compared to other autos, to other workers. So there's a real struggle going on, and the problem, Amy, is it's being done in a frantically rushed manner, and that's bad, because this is a very complex package they have to work out if they're going to further the regulatory goals. And if they're going to restructure the industry.
And Ralph, isn't one of the key issues in terms of the huge losses of the auto companies is the health payments, the health insurance payments that they have to make, which in essence are a reflection of the country's continuing inability to have a universal health insurance. Wouldn't that, to some degree, be a great assist to the auto companies if we could fashion some kind of a health care plan?
Exactly. The foreign auto companies operate out of countries that have universal health care, like in Europe and in Japan. Out of the rubble of World War II, they gave their people universal health care. Out of the victory of World War II in the United States, we still don't have it. And that would relieve hundreds of dollars per car, in effect, the expense of producing a car, if we had universal health care and the domestic industry could be more competitive. But somebody's going to have to pay for the mismanagement, and that means the board of directors and the executives, maybe with one or two exceptions, have got to be removed in a sort of trusteeship that has to be established over these companies.
Some people call GM a healthcare company that makes cars. They spend more for healthcare than they do for steel, talking about going to Ontario because they have single-payer healthcare in Canada, unless Harper succeeds in dismantling it, but if he remains the prime minister.
That's correct.
Well, Wendy Thompson, I'd like to ask you, you're the international leaders of the UAW. You're raising these issues in this grassroots effort, but are your union leaders at this point willing to break with this the past policies of continuing to support the policies of the CEOs of these companies?
Well, again, we feel it's very important that a rank-and-file point of view be presented here. And that is why we're going to Washington, to present the point of view that we as workers are coming down firmly on the side of fuel-efficient cars, saving the planet. We don't think it's right to take health care away from those who have it. Let's expand it to everyone, and that is a part of our proposal, single-payer health care for everyone. You don't take away a decent livelihood from one group, and then it exists for no one. If you've got it for one group, you keep it and you expand it to everyone. I agree that the role of the government is key here, and that the people have to have a say in the government, and therefore a say in what happens in the industry. And that is why we're going to Washington.
I wanted to turn for a minute to this film called Who Killed the Electric Car? In 1996, General Motors introduced the EV1 electric car in California and Arizona. Hundreds of the electric cars were soon on the road. Then they all disappeared. The mystery behind their disappearance is the subject of this documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car, which we featured on Democracy Now! Last year. This is an excerpt.
There's nothing like driving a car where you realize, as you're sitting in traffic, there's no pollution coming out of your tailpipe. There's just sitting there with batteries on.
By driving an electric car, what are you sparing us from?
I'm saving America, Dave. That's what I'm doing. I am saving America by driving an electric car.
That was Tom Hanks speaking on the David Letterman Show. Despite the praise from drivers, General Motors stopped manufacturing the cars and forced all drivers to return their EV1s. GM was able to do this because none of the cars had actually been sold, only leased. After the electric cars were removed from the road, they were sent to Arizona, where they were crushed.
We flew over at General Motors, and looking down, we could see right next to the racetrack where the EV1 was first tested, we saw, I don't know, maybe 50 EV1s crushed and put on top of semi-flatbeds right next to the yellow crusher. General Motors is almost finished off. I think, I don't imagine there's very many EV1s left that haven't been crushed down. It's pretty sad.
They're one of four things that will happen with the EV1s. They'll go to colleges and universities, engineering schools. They'll go to museums and other displays across the country. Other EV1 vehicles are being driven by our engineers, and the other option for the EV1s at the end of their life is recycling. But know that every part of the EV1 is going to be recycled, dismantled through a third party, and then reused. Everything is going to be recycled. We're not just going to crush it and send it off to a landfill.
I saw the picture of the pile of crushed cars. It hurt, and I thought it was pretty spiteful.
To see on the, on the computer, on the internet, the crushed EV1s that GM did.
It was wrong. It was wrong.
That an excerpt of Who Killed the Electric Car by Chris Payne. Ralph Nader, now, after the first debacle of the automakers coming to Washington in their corporate jets, they drove up in fuel-efficient vehicles. Final comment on this.
It's the same kind of window dressing they've been engaged in, especially GM, since the 1939 New York World's Fair. They dangle the electric car, they dangle new kinds of propulsion systems, but it never happens. We're still saddled with the infernal, eternal, internal combustion engine. And GM came yesterday with the Volt. The Volt is going to cost at least $40,000 to $50,000 to anybody who wants to buy it. That's just more window dressing by GM. That's why the management and the board of directors have to be removed completely and put in people who really know how to produce cars that are in consonant with consumer needs and the environment. And we should know that the auto suppliers are really the source of innovation here. There are a lot of brilliant engineers and scientists and management types that are available that have circled around this forlorn, mismanaged industry for years, but have never been given the responsibility for it. And people have just got to get Congress to put numbers on this. You know, the bailout of Citibank, $300 billion on the backs of the taxpayer risk, and another $45 billion in preferred shares for one bank. This so-called bailout could only cost $10 billion if it works, for example, of the taxpayer. And the taxpayer could get $20, $30, $40 billion back in appreciated stock value. So we need to be much more demanding of Congress, and we need to learn more about corporations. And I can give you the website for the multinational magazine, which is multinationalmonitor.org, because without an informed public, we won't realize what the full parameters of this is. Auto workers have shrunken in number by two-thirds in the last 15, 20 years. The UAW has lost two-thirds. They have given up tens and tens of billions of dollars, the workers, and that's not coming to the forefront compared to what the government is offering.
I want to thank Wendy Thompson for being with us. We'll follow that trip you take to Washington, D.C., UAW Local 235, former president, helping to organize this auto caravan. Again, that website, Wendy?
www.autoworkercaravan.org.
Thanks for being with us. She's joining us from Detroit today. She'll be in Washington on Monday. And I want to stay with Ralph Nader. We're also joined by Medea Benjamin, longtime grassroots activist and founder of the group Code Pink, just returned from a week-long citizen diplomacy mission to Iran, where she met with advisors to the Iranian president, two women parliament members, NGO leaders, and women's groups. And I want to talk with both of you about the cabinet picks. Juan and I have some questions, starting with Ralph Nader. Just go through the cabinet picks. Again, they have to be approved of Barack Obama, your, well, former opponent. You ran for president as well, Ralph Nader.
Well, it's symbolized in an article in the newspapers a day or two ago. The headline was, Obama turns to consider liberals for cabinet positions. I mean, you know, after appointing all the heavyweights, keeping Gates as Secretary of Defense, Hillary Clinton at State Department, and other positions, Treasury, for example, coming from Wall Street, the article said, well, it's time now to consider some liberal appointees. Well, what's left? Department of Labor. Now, will David Bonnier, who is a genuine progressive and spent many years in the House of Representatives from Michigan, get the job? That remains to be seen. It's really interesting. As long as liberals and progressives gave Obama a pass during the election and didn't demand anything in return, he knew that he had their votes and he had their support regardless, and moved right, moved to the corporate. And that's reflected in the appointments that he has been putting in place. Now we look forward to the second level. Who's going to be Food and Drug Administration head? Who's going to be the head of the Auto Safety Agency or EPA? Will so-called liberals and progressives get their share of the Obama administration at that second level? It remains to be seen, but the signs are not very auspicious.
Well, the New York Times was reporting today that he may name California Congressman Javier Becerra to be the U.S. Trade Representative. And Becerra has been a critic of free trade agreements in the past. But the in general, have you been surprised by the number of former Clinton administration officials that he has named?
Who hasn't? You know, he defeated Hillary Clinton in a close race, and now he's reinstalling the Bill Clinton administration. Now, there are two interpretations, briefly here. One, it could reflect his insecurity. That way, by putting Clintonites all over the government and keeping Gates, he's basically eliminating a lot of potential centers of criticism and challenge to his administration after January 20. The second interpretation is more benign, and that is that he wants to elevate the State Department so it isn't dominated by the Defense Department and the security apparatus, and push for a more benign foreign policy with more vigorous diplomacy instead of brute force, more attention to infectious diseases, environmental issues, land erosion, agricultural cooperatives, etc., which are much cheaper than ballooning a huge, wasteful military budget. And if that is his goal, then the fact that he's put Gates there for at least a year means that there isn't a new Secretary of Defense to build up a powerful base to dominate State Department. And putting Hillary, who's a world-recognized figure, regardless of her policies, into State Department, which will elevate the State Department. That's the more benign approach, but we'll see how it plays out.
What about Marine General Jim Jones, nominated as National Security Advisor? Interestingly, President Bush's first National Security Advisor, of course, was Condoleezza Rice. She came from the board of Chevron. That's exactly where Marine General Jim Jones comes from. Jim Jones comes from Chevron and the board of Boeing, and the chief executive of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Institute for 21st Century Energy, which has been criticized by environmental groups for, among other things, calling for the immediate expansion of domestic oil and gas production and issuing reports that challenge the use of the Clean Air Act to combat global warming.
Well, Jim Jones is basically the representative of what President Eisenhower cautioned us about, the military-industrial complex. He's experienced, he's clever, and now he's in the White House. So the question is, who's going to run what? Is Obama going to transform Jim Jones? Is Obama going to transform all these establishment appointees? Or are they going to, in effect, transform him in contrast to his more liberal rhetoric? It's very hard to appoint people with fixed opinions, fixed constituencies around the country of vested power, and say, well, we're going to use these to change America, because if they change, that will give great credibility, and that will offset the corporate power structure from Washington, D.C. You know, that's never been done before, Amy. Usually when you appoint people who have fixed positions, who have experience in set ways, who represent the power structure, they're not about to be steered into a progressive path of hope and change by someone at the top in the Oval Office.
Well, Medea, you've just returned, Medea Benjamin, you've just returned from Iran and with conversations with various people in the Iranian government and civil society. What's your sense of how they're viewing the Obama presidency and what it holds in store for them?
They're very cautious. The young people were excited about Barack Obama. The political leaders, not so. They say we're not really interested in words and talk about hope and change. We want to see some real change in policy. We are concerned, they tell us, about the Secretary of State, about Hillary Clinton, about Rahm Emanuel, about several other of the people that are advising the president-elect. They look at people like Dennis Ross, who said recently in a Newsweek article that the Bush administration wasn't doing enough to push Iran. There are a group of people that are surrounding Barack Obama that have said that sanctions should be tightened, are talking about a naval blockade that would stop oil exports from leaving Iran and would stop refined petroleum products from going into Iran. It would be absolutely disastrous for the Iranian people. So they're very concerned, and rightly so. And that's why we in the progressive movement have to stake out our positions very clearly. We have to say that Barack Obama promised direct talks without preconditions. We want those talks to happen. And rather than a tightening of the sanction, we want a lifting of the sanctions.
Medea Benjamin, this issue of organizing, I mean, maybe Barack Obama modeled it, although I think the figures have come out for the amount of money he spent on this campaign. We were closing in, I think, on $1 billion. Was it $750 million? But the other aspect is the remarkable community organizing, which might be a model now for people to take up critiquing his policies. But you are well known for being co-founder of Global Exchange and now Code Pink. You're moving to Washington completely to continue your work, not in the Bush administration, but in the Obama administration. Why? What are you going to do? How are you mobilizing?
We feel like this is the moment for us as organizers. Yesterday, there were 2,000 organizers that were brought into Washington, D.C., many of them coming from the community organization where Barack Obama was trained in Chicago, talking about how we have to be there to push this administration forward. Groups are planning January, February, bringing thousands of people to Washington, and also to be part of this 10 million email list that has been created. In fact, today they sent out a message from Barack Obama's people saying, we want you to organize house parties December 13th and 14th to give us your ideas. And it's called Change is Coming. We tell progressives, go to those meetings. Whether you voted for Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, or Barack Obama, go to those meetings and be part of this community that's going to have the ear of this new administration. You can go to my.barackobama.com/changes coming, find out where the events are, create ones in your own community, and, you know, essentially have progressives infiltrate this vast network of organizers.
Do you have any sense of the year of the administration?
We have people we know that have been appointed or are our advisors. I mean, we're excited that some people with some progressive views are going to be in this administration. We have friends who are moving to Washington to take lower-level positions. And we feel like we cannot give up and say, just because we don't like the cabinet positions, we don't like a lot of the people he's appointed, that we're going to say, okay, you know, he's already betrayed us. No, we got to get in there and be in there from day one. We're even part of organizing an inaugural Peace Ball on the day of the inauguration that sold out in 1 week, 1,000 people. Amy Goodman's going to be there. I hope Juan will be there to say peace is on the agenda. We're going to be at the airports. We're going to be at Union Station in Washington, D.C. when people arrive to the inauguration with quotes of Barack Obama and other people saying, you know, this is what he stood for. He stood for getting the troops out of Iraq. He stood for talks without preconditions. We're going to remind people as they come in that this is what we're hoping will happen.
And how will you deal with Afghanistan? He supports a surge in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is one promise we don't want him to fulfill. And we have to get out there very quickly. And we are building up as a peace movement to take on the issue of Afghanistan, to say that this is not a, quote, good war, that this has to be a negotiated solution, and that we want to get our troops out of Afghanistan. And more than that, Amy, we have to start taking on the Pentagon budget. Barney Frank came out recently and said cut the Pentagon budget by 25%. That's a great way to start. Let's put our support behind that and say let's close down these bases that we have overseas. Let's take the $10 billion that we're spending on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, use them for domestic purposes, and let's start reigning in the empire.
Well, one last comment.
I just wanted to ask Ralph Nader about the dangers, the potential dangers that occur in periods when there are political shifts like this and progressives come to office. What happens in terms of the popular movement and the dangers that the popular movement faces in these times of change?
Well, they do have to mobilize, as Medea said. I mean, mobilize in the streets and marches and pressure on members of Congress. The issue now moves to Congress. That's where the action is going to be on health care. That's going to be on issues of war and peace, constitutionalism, et cetera. So that definitely is the case. But it certainly would have eased the mission of progressives all over the country had they conditioned their support of Obama in return for certain concessions and certain recognitions and policy before the election, rather than just wait until after the election when he's draped around himself corporate and other establishment figures from the national security apparatus and the Wall Street apparatus. So it's an uphill fight, but there's no alternative. I mean, there's got to now basically say, okay, Barack, you gave us a lot of rhetoric, hope and change and hope, and it's time to produce. And that's what people have to do in every congressional district. And we're looking at November5.org, the website, to invite people to see whether they want to form Congress action groups in congressional districts to focus, for example, on single-payer health care, which has 95 members of the House already supporting the Conyers bill, H.R. 676. So it is mobilization time. And the hope, of course, is like Nixon opened up relations with China. The Democrats couldn't do it because they were concerned of being accused of being soft on communism. So maybe Barack Obama's corporate establishment can be steered in that direction.
Ralph Nader, we want to thank you for being with us.
Transforming leader.
Thank you very much for being with us. Longtime consumer advocate, also former presidential candidate. His first book that catapulted him to fame, Unsafe at Any Speed, that took on the auto industry. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, moving to Washington for this administration.
Thank you. And can I just add, come to Washington on a regular basis, go to the hearings. If we pack those hearings, the people's voices will be inside of Congress. And contact us at Code Pink. We have a house. You can come and stay there.
Your website.
CodePinkAlert.org.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, what happened in Nigeria earlier this week, the killings of perhaps 400 people, then the blogging revolution. Stay with us.
Oh,
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to Nigeria, where up to 400 people were believed killed last week in violent clashes over disputed election results in the central Nigerian city of Jos. Christian and Muslim protesters took to the streets Friday, killing people, burning down homes, mosques, churches over what they said were rigged election results. At least 7,000 people were forced to flee their homes. Authorities imposed a curfew over Jos, and security forces were reportedly given shoot-on-site orders. For more insight, a few days ago, I spoke to Nigerian activist and journalist Omoyele Sowore. Sowore has been arrested and tortured by the Nigerian military. Now here in the United States, runs the website SaharaReporters.com.
What has happened in Nigeria is that since 1999, when we had this return of democracy, so to speak, there has been consistent violation of democratic tenets and principles, especially election rigging. And the Nigerian people have not had a chance to choose their leaders, and also have not had a chance to express their anger whenever the few cabal who run the country, members of the ruling elite, decide to turn elections against the choices of the people. So you now have a country that is filled up, or like I say, that's doused in gas. And anytime there is a little violation of these democratic tenets and basic civil rights of the people, it escalates in ways that nobody can imagine. Very fast, very quickly, and, you know, very seriously.
And what exactly happened?
This time around, there was an election that took place, a local government election of all elections, and somebody who was supposed to win by 58,000 margin was denied victory. And the reaction was instantaneous. Don't forget that even the current president had the same experience. The rigged election. The elections in 2007 April were so bad that on Sahara Reporters we got election results 24 hours before the elections took place. That is the kind of things that you saw led to what happened in Jos. But I'm quite disappointed that he got a kind of miserable coverage he got in the mainstream media in this country.
It
when Mumbai, where less people died, got...
Right.
You know.
Well, it was much more conveyed as a confrontation, a religious confrontation between Christians and Muslims.
That is where I was expressing disappointment, is that nobody has really spoken to the root of the problem. That is the fact that Nigerians want real democracy, and they've been denying this consistently since 1999 in recent times, of course, their entire life. And the sectarian part of it was the interpretation given to the crisis by the people in government, not what happened on the ground. So, but my analogy is that, like I said, if a house is doused with gas and any part of it catches fire, the part with most gas will, of course, burn faster and more seriously, and perhaps more fatal.
Are the Muslim and Christian communities at odds with each other?
I don't believe so, because the reason is that the crisis has now been extinguished. If it is true that it's a Muslim versus Christian thing that they want us to believe, the crisis could not have been contained, because you're talking about 50-50, almost, roughly, the population of Christians and Muslims in Nigeria. What I'm saying, and what we should not lose sight of, is the problem is justice in Nigeria and poor leadership. We shouldn't lose sight of this.
It was the Muslim party, the predominantly Muslim party, that got denied the election, and the...
The truth is that there's no political party in Nigeria that's predominantly Christian or Muslim. You know, the parties in Nigeria, the major parties, are predominantly greedy and greedy people.
Do you think the violence will continue now?
For as long as there's injustice in Nigeria of any democratic type, you cannot predict what will happen in that country. That much I can tell you. If there is justice, of course there will be peace. There's no question about it. It's as simple as that.
Omoyele Sowore is a Nigerian activist, and he runs the website SaharaReporters.com. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, a new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists says more internet journalists are jailed today than journalists in any other medium. At least 56 online journalists are jailed worldwide, according to CPJ's census, a tally that surpasses the number of print journalists for the first time. The number of imprisoned online journalists has steadily increased since CPJ recorded the first jailed internet writer in its 1997 census.
Our next guest traveled to Iran, to Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, and China in 2007 to look at bloggers around the world. He is Anthony Lowenstein. He wrote The Blogging Revolution. Welcome. Talk about blogging in these countries, why people are ending up in jail.
The bottom line is that many, many people in these countries, of course, can't rely on state-run media, which is propaganda. Bloggers and blogging is a way to try and express different views. So in every country I went to, except for Cuba, where the internet is very underdeveloped, you have situations where people are blogging about sex, about drugs, about gender issues, about politics. The majority of people in these countries don't blog politically. They blog about their personal lives, about their boyfriends, their girlfriends. But there is, increasingly, as that report states, many, many regimes who are fearful of the fact that you have independent voices, simply put. In China, for example, I think it said there were 35 people who were imprisoned. Many of those people, some of those people, I should add, with the assistance of Western multinationals like Yahoo, who have actually given information to the regime to assist these people being put in jail. Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, Cisco, other security firms, internet firms, have sadly and shamefully been involved in these kind of complicity acts. And it seems one of the things I discuss in the book is to actually have more transparency about how those guys actually operate in those kind of countries. A place like Iran, say, most population are very, very young. So what you find is that despite Ahmadinejad and Jack cracking down on dissent, which has undoubtedly happened in the last 3 years, you still find a very, very vibrant online community, far more vibrant than you get in most of the Western media. So there is, despite the crackdowns and despite the imprisonment, discussion about politics between reformists and liberals, and for that matter, conservatives. And one of the things that comes out, I think, very clearly is that many people in these countries resent how the Western media reports them. New York Times, those sort of papers.
Well, even in Iran, you noted that there's an American company there, Secure Computing, that was providing a filter for Iran to be able to filter out information on the internet.
The company denies it's involved. So, but my understanding is that they actually are involved, and this is what you find in country after country. That although Western multinationals often talk about human rights and democracy, we've seen in the last 5 years these companies actually operating to make a buck. China is, for example, the biggest internet market in the world. 250 million users, 6 million users going online every month. America's got about 230 million people, roughly, online. So surprise, surprise, they want to make a buck. And what you find increasingly is that companies like that are also moving into other nations. And one of the things I discuss in the book is we too much in the West think about these issues happening over there somewhere, China, Iran, rather than happening here. And I think what we need to look at more closely is how these companies might operate when they behave in the West. And for that matter, are they exporting their oppression elsewhere as well?
What about Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia made Iran seem liberal in comparison. The online community in Saudi Arabia is not massive, but certainly growing. I spent some time with some prominent bloggers there who are relatively liberal in a Saudi sense. And one of the challenges they have, that censorship actually in Saudi is quite minimal, believe it or not. There are websites that are blocked by the kingdom, but most of them actually are relatively available. What you find there is a great discussion between so-called liberal reformers who actually want to try and make the possibility of a liberal, more open Islam a possibility. And there's often a great deal of competition online between more hardliners and conservatives who believe in a more fundamentalist interpretation of Islam and more individuals who believe in a more liberal, open, relatively democratic Islam.
Egypt.
Egypt, again, arguably the most vibrant online community in the Middle East. There's been a great deal of actually change there because of the internet, not least because of torture. Torture videos that are increasingly now published on blogs. The government has been forced to respond. Torture still goes on, of course, but it's becoming a lot less. And one of the things that strikes me is that a lot of social networking sites, Facebook, YouTube, actually are increasingly being used to organize dissent against the US-backed regime.
Mm. Well, Anthony Lowenstein, I want to thank you for being with us and writing this book. I know you head back to Australia tomorrow. The Blogging Revolution is the name of his book. He'll be speaking at Blue Stockings in New York tonight. You can go to our website for the contact information, democracynow.org. And I'm headed to Sweden. I'll be speaking publicly on Tuesday night at Stockholm University, on Friday night at Berlin at Humboldt University. You can go to our website for the details on that. And we'll be broadcasting from Stockholm, Sweden next week. We'll be interviewing the Right Livelihood Award winners on Monday, talking about the Nobel Prizes on Tuesday, and then we'll be broadcasting from Germany, among the places, Berlin. And that does it for our show today. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodoka Duzar, Amate, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Magero, Peter Curry, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.